Good evening. My name is Amanda Soa, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are gathered today in a place that lies within the traditional territory of the Susquehannock, the Shawnee, and the Lenape indigenous peoples who inhabited this land for centuries prior to the arrival of European settlers. On behalf of the Clark Forum, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, I am pleased to welcome you to tonight's event, Fallout from the American Military Withdrawal from Northern Syria. Last month, President Donald Trump's definitive decision to withdraw troops from Northeast Syria was met with outcry and confusion. This was because such action could possibly allow the government of Turkey to invade the Syrian Kurds that live in the northern part of Syria. The Kurds are a displaced ethnic group living in countries such as Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. Currently, the Kurds make up more than 10% of Turkey's population. Turkey's fight with the Syrian Kurds began with a violent protest of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, a socialist group fighting for Kurdish independence in Turkey in the 1980s. The relationship became more strained when an offshoot, the Kurdish People's Party, began to grow in 2004. In 2015, the Kurdish People's Party created the Syrian Democratic Forces, which has become one of the key forces in defeating the Islamic State, popularly known as ISIS. Currently, the Turkish media still views the growing influence of the Syrian Democratic Forces as a threat because of its relations with the Kurdish Workers' Party. Turkey is a member of the North Atlantic Trade Organization, of which the U.S. is also a part. At the same time, the U.S. has been working with the Syrian Democratic Forces to defeat ISIS. Because of the unique relationships the U.S. has with both countries, there is not necessarily a clear way to act. Congress has taken a stand and has passed a non-binding resolution on Turkey opposing the president's decision. Other politicians have also condemned the president's decision, claiming that it will undermine the task force against ISIS. The withdrawal is seen as a radical solution as the lack of troops could potentially cause an ethnic war and will ultimately affect our national security. As a student, I have come to understand the peacemaker position that the United States has undertaken. I have also come to see the lack of focus on foreign affairs in classroom settings. The Syrian and Turkey conflict highlights the slippery slope of U.S. involvement in foreign affairs. President Trump's decision has drawn a lot of criticism, but he made a decision about a situation in which there does not seem to be a right answer. I count myself fortunate enough to be part of this discussion to learn more about a topic that could have grave impact on me and my fellow citizens. Tonight, our panelists will walk us through the ramifications of the withdrawal of troops and what it means for the Syrian Kurds and the Turkish government. I am now pleased to introduce our panelists. Our moderator tonight, Jacob Uduudu. Jacob is a visiting international scholar in the International Studies program who oversees Dickinson's College Bridge program. His teaching and research interests are located at the intersections between communications and violent extremism, war and peace in contemporary society. Before coming to Dickinson, Jacob was the chair of communications and multimedia program as well as the dean of arts and science at the American University of Nigeria. Jacob currently co-leads the development of an ethical and methodological guide on preventing or countering violent extremism research for the Resolve Network Policy and Practice Research Hub housed within the United States Institute of Peace. David Commons is the Benjamin Rush in the Liberal Arts and Science and a professor of history at Dickinson College. His interests include modern Middle East history with an emphasis on Islamic thought and political movement. He has written on Syrian history, modern Islamic thought, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf. He's the author of the books Islam in Saudi Arabia, The Gulf States, A Modern History, The Wahhabi Mission, and Saudi Arabia, Historical Dictionary of Syria and Islamic Reform. A question and answer session. Sorry. Larry Goodson is a professor of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College, where he's the only person to hold the General Dwight D. Eisenhower Chair of National Security twice. Since joining the U.S. government in 2002, Goodson has been continually called upon to serve as a regional advisor on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Middle East by senior U.S. military and political leaders. He has lectured on Afghanistan, Pakistan, Islam, and the Middle East to audiences at more than 100 universities, schools, and organizations, and has been interviewed more than 1,000 times on these subjects since September 11, 2001. Chris Bolin is a professor of Middle East Studies at the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College, where he researches, publishes, and teaches graduate-level courses on U.S. national security, foreign policy, and the Middle East. He served as a foreign policy advisor in Middle East and South Asia affairs for Vice President Gore and Cheney from 1997 to 2003. He's also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization. His most recent article, 10 Hard Realities of America's Next Syria Policy, was published by Defense One on October 18th. A question and answer session will follow the lecture, so please hold all questions until then. The Clark Forum welcomes differences of opinion expressed politely, thoughtfully, and succinctly. Disruptive behavior or harassment of the speaker and members of the Dickinson community or audience will not be tolerated. As a show of respect of our speakers and everyone in attendance, please stay until the end of the program, including the question and answer session. At this time, I ask you to please silence all cell phones and other electronic devices. Please know that the handicap accessible exits are located on the west side of this building, right here. And now, please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Thank you so much, Amanda, for that brilliant introduction. And I wish to welcome everybody here. Thank you so much for making the time to come out tonight. There's really nothing much that I can add to that very brilliant synopsis by Amanda. We have just one question that we are trying to have answers to tonight. What are the geopolitical, even geostrategic implications of the abrupt withdrawal of U.S. forces in northern Syria? And we have an expert panel that have all the answers tonight. I tell you they do. Right, without taking much of your time, the introductions have already been done, and I'll tell you how this would go. First of all, I'll invite Larry Goodson, and he'll make his presentation, after which Chris Bolin will follow, and then after that, David Cummins. Then after that, we'll have a bit of a discussion among ourselves. Then we'll open it up to you for questions, and hopefully they'll have all the answers. Please help me welcome one more time the panelists.
Is this on? Okay. Good evening. I'm Larry Goodson from the U.S. Army War College. I work for the government, so disclaimer, the views I express are mine, not those of the War College or the Department of the Army or Defense or the government. I'm supposed to go first and in 10 minutes set up this whole thing for my colleagues who really are very good. So I don't know if I can do that in 10 minutes or 100 minutes, but with one eye on the clock, here goes. So, of course, the Syrian conflict grew out of the Arab Spring events of 2011. It created real challenges in Washington for our government because we simultaneously favored an outcome that did away with the al-Assad regime in Damascus. But then in 2013 and 2014, having withdrawn our forces from Iraq, we saw the rise of ISIS in the cauldron that was the Syrian civil war. We began to think about how do we go after the ISIS forces that were part of the opposition to the government in Damascus. And so our interests, as we looked at the Middle East, now I'm not talking about anything else that was going on in the Middle East, but our interest in regard to Syria centered on these two sort of divergent goals. We, of course, constructed by the end of 2014 Operation Inherent Resolve, which would be a U.S.-led coalition of many, many countries. I don't know what it is now, Chris,
67, 68.
And other forces like the Kurdish protection units that were that would turn into the Syrian Democratic Forces that are the Kurds in question as we talk about this tonight. They would sort of be the ground forces primarily, and we provided a lot more of the headquarters leadership and the air forces and the logistical forces, as well as some special operations and ground forces of our own. So that's in general. Of course, there are many other countries and actors involved. I've been gone from the War College for the last year over on sabbatical in England, where I've been working on a book that looks at whether or not there is a great war going on in the 21st century, or maybe for you international relations folks here in the audience, a great power war. And so the title is The First Great War of the 21st Century, From Syria to the South China Sea. My argument is that the struggle between the United States, China, and Russia, what Graham Allison would refer to with regard to China as the Thucydides trap, is underway already. That now that we have multiple domains of warfare, not just sort of land and sea, but air and space and cyber, the Russians and the Chinese have adopted, in the face of overwhelming American military conventional superiority, at least we think, in an age where big conventional wars between big powers is something everyone wants to avoid since there's this big nuclear umbrella overhead, they've adopted a hybrid warfare approach, which is to leverage proxies in these different countries, or little green men, as they were called in Crimea and Ukraine, right, or the Wagner Group in Syria, and to use cyber attacks and all these other methods of warfare to get at the United States and to attack U.S. interests. So in Syria, we see some of the plays from that playbook having unfolded over the last few years. Russia has interests in Syria, having to do with their alliance with the Assad government, but also having to do with their naval presence there and now their air presence. Since 2017, they've declared permanent military presence in Syria. Their ideological connection to the earlier Arab socialist or Ba'athist governments there, and the geopolitical position, Turkey being a historic enemy, let's say, of Russia, to find a way to get beyond Turkey into the eastern Mediterranean. Turkey, of course, well, let me leave Turkey aside for a minute. Saudi Arabia and Iran have interests that are largely driven by the sectarian division that's in play in Syria and has been for many years, and their rivalry within the broader Middle East. Iran supporting the Alawi Shia government in Syria, and Saudi Arabia supporting the Sunni opposition, primarily Sunni opposition forces in Syria. Turkey has a different problem set, which is, you know, there are these Kurds in northern Syria, and there are these Kurds in eastern, southeastern Turkey and in northern Iraq and in northwestern Iran. And no one wants the Kurds to have a state. Better that they be divided amongst these countries. And in particular, in southeastern Turkey, there's this massive hydroelectric project there right in the heart of Kurdish country that is central to Turkish national interests. So any notion of a Kurdish state or a Kurdish identity that transcends the borders threatens that, as well as, of course, a Turkish party, the PKK, that is on the foreign terrorist organization list of the U.S. State Department, the U.S. government, is widely viewed. You might have seen President Erdogan in the White House today, you know, showing this to senators and the president as a terrorist organization. And this widespread view in Turkey amongst the government leadership that all the Kurds, whether they're Syrian Kurds, you know, Iraqi Kurds or Turkish Kurds, whatever, are really kind of connected together with PKK, that their ethnicity sort of dominates their nationality or their tribal identities. Kurds are divided, you know, internally, just as everyone else in the Middle East seems to be. So those are some basic background pieces to sort of set up my colleagues. And I guess in the last minute or so, I'll just say that for the United States, we've never had a really very coherent policy, in my mind, with regard to Syria. Because, as I said from the beginning, we stood against Bashar al-Assad's government, but then we stood up a military operation to primarily attack ISIS. And eventually we had to share the battle space with Russians, who were right there as well, who wanted to support the Assad government and really kind of wanted to attack anyone who was against that government, which would include the Kurdish forces that were providing our ground troops as they were establishing a somewhat autonomous region in northeastern Syria. Ultimately, something was going to have to give, and I wrote a piece last week in the War Room that some of you may have read, in which I told the famous story from the 1970s where, you know, Henry Kissinger, our Secretary of State, back in that era, or I guess our National Security Advisor at that time, set up a covert action program to support the Kurds in Iraq against Saddam Hussein on behalf of our allies and friends, the Iranians. Yes, that's how far back in history it was. And he did, until the famous Shatt al-Arab issue was resolved and the Algiers Agreement was signed in 1975. And then the Kurds were cut off. The Turks and the Iranians closed the border to the Kurds so they couldn't escape. And then Saddam's bully boys came north and did the rest of the job. And in the testimony before Congress, the investigation of this, Kissinger famously said, covert action should not be confused with missionary work. And I always remember that. This was 2 years after he received the Nobel Peace Prize, because it's a wonderfully ugly sort of statement of realism, of political realism, and the way the Kurds have always been a bargaining chip and a tool, and of course they've played the folks who want to use them as a tool as well, because they recognize the position they're in, and now we're in another cycle of that. So I think that's my best effort in 10 minutes to set you guys up. Now you'll hear from these gentlemen here.
Okay, so I'm next up in the batting order, even though I hate using sports analogies when we talk international relations. But I'm going to focus on U.S. policy. And before I do that, I mean, I always find it's really useful for me to remind myself of something that Richard Haass has frequently said. I mean, he was an advisor to multiple presidential administrations, both on the NSC and in the State Policy Planning Group. And he reminds folks that when you're debating policy issues, I mean, very often these substantive issues are a 49-51 split. I mean, there are super good arguments on both sides. Very often you're kind of left to choose the least worst among a series of bad. options. So they're tough decisions, tough discussions, and the things that I say are certainly debatable. So, you know, we can have at it. I suspect some of my observations, folks on the panel will have different views. But I'll offer a few in terms of U.S. policy. And first, the first 2 points are U.S. policy really faces 2 major structural issues in Syria, and they're going to confront any administration, Republican or Democrat. I think the U.S. has less vital interest engaged in Syria than virtually all of the other, at least outside and to some extent, inside players in Syria. And this puts us at a real disadvantage. It doesn't mean we don't have influence or an opportunity to move events in a particular direction. But what it does mean is that these other players who are countering us have even more incentive to counterbalance whatever we're going to do, and they're likely going to attempt to overmatch something we do. So you've got to really consider the prospects for escalation. But just take a look at Assad, of course. I mean, for him, this is literally a matter of life and death. So he's not going to go quietly into the night. For Russia, Syria is really their only Cold War remaining ally, and they were not in the wake of watching the other Arab uprisings and decades of U.S. dominance in the region. They were not going to let that ally go quietly into the night either. Iran, similar to Russia, Syria has played a key role in their ability to ship weapons to Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which provides Iran with really their only serious substantive deterrent against an Israeli attack. And for Turkey, as Larry mentioned, their number one security issue is preventing an autonomous or independent Kurdish region on their borders. And they will pull no punches in making sure that that objective is accomplished. Whereas from the U.S. standpoint, our interests are really kind of indirect and tangential. Yes, there's certainly the fight for ISIS is an important one, but even in Syria, Syria is one theater in a global battle against these terrorist groups, right? So Syria is only one theater. You've also got to think about Afghanistan, Iraq, North Africa, Southern Asia, as well, where ISIS has any number of so-called vilayats established, Africa as well. So Syria is kind of a minor part in our overall global strategy. The second thing is, I think it was actually fairly clear from the beginning that Assad really was in the advantageous position here. And Russia, Iran, in terms of backing Assad, had the easier battle in this fight. They were supporting an authoritarian leader who possessed all the state instruments of violence and repression at his disposal, whereas the U.S. was looking at trying to forge a non-existent alliance among disparate, weak, and factionalized Syrian opposition groups. And President Obama tried on several occasions to actually have a covert and overt train and equip program that just never went anywhere because of that factionalization. Moreover, some of those groups in the Syrian opposition either prioritized the ouster of Assad over the battle against ISIS, or they also had jihadist elements in their own ranks. So that was problematic for the United States. Now, I think this was particularly clear once Assad took Aleppo in late 2016. Aleppo, next to Damascus, is arguably the most populous and important economic center in the country. And that really left Assad in control of some two-thirds of the country territorially, but even more importantly, about 80% of the population. So since then, it's been fairly apparent that he has the upper hand. He's not going to be going anywhere. And frankly, I think U.S. policy really hasn't adapted to that reality. In terms of U.S. strategy in Syria, scrambling for a silver lining, I suppose. I mean, I do think you can say our strategy against ISIS was largely successful. I mean, President Obama laid this out in a September 2014 speech. He set a fairly limited objective focused really on degrading ISIS, although he did say in the eventual defeat. And we can talk in Q&A about whether that's a realistic objective or not. But he really harnessed a full set of national instruments of power, and he did it again in a similar and a sustainable way. It was going to be U.S. air power, limited boots on the ground, and we're going to work a buy with and through strategy looking for viable partners on the ground in Syria. The only viable partners that emerged in that military fight were the Syrian Kurds that put us on an inevitable direct head-on-head confrontation with Turkey, the second largest military in NATO and a NATO partner. So that was something that was really baked into U.S. policy in terms of an internal friction from the very beginning. Where I think U.S. strategy kind of went awry was after the defeat of ISIS, because our public strategy had been focused on defeating ISIS. So really, U.S. policy, that was kind of a turning point. It was a natural inflection point for U.S. strategy. And like any good military strategist, you offer the folks three options, right? So, I mean, one sensible option at the time, and these are all debatable, but would be you just declare victory and you withdraw your military forces. The mission's done. U.S. strategic objective has been accomplished, and we're pulling out. The more sensible thing, I think, would have been to admit that, look, we're now in a new transitional point for U.S. strategy. We ought to de-emphasize the military component, not necessarily eliminate it, but de-emphasize it and really harness and focus on the diplomatic piece through Geneva, harness and focus on economic instruments in terms of building more efficient, local, effective governance structures in the region that could actually do something if there ever was a post-Assad regime. And then the third one, of course, would have been to just formulate a new strategic objective. I mean, strategic objectives do change. And that's kind of where I think we're at now, whereas rather than kind of identifying a strategic objective up front that makes sense, and then figuring out what military force posture, what diplomacy, what economic instruments we need to apply, we've kind of just gotten into the spaghetti approach where senior leaders are just throwing up any excuse for a continued U.S. military presence, which is really working strategy in kind of in a reverse direction. And any one of those objectives is problematic, but you've seen them. I mean, one was National Security Advisor Bolton said, we're here to protect the Kurds. Well, obviously, we weren't structured enough for that. I mean, you can just witness current events there. So we were ill-postured for that. Secretary Pompeo has really been emphasizing about, well, we're going to be there until the Iranian forces are ousted from Syria. Well, that's not going to happen because, again, that's in Iranian vital interest. The Israelis have actually undertaken fairly sustained military operations against Iranian forces and allied units in Syria for a fairly sustained period of time, and that hasn't budged them. So if the U.S. were serious about that as an objective, it would take a major military intervention to actually oust the Iranians, and I don't think anybody's interested in doing that. And, of course, the latest is keep the oil. And really, the military has been in a very difficult situation trying to kind of make a round insert into a square hole, because you've got they've been saying we're really there to protect the Kurds, to secure the Kurds, and maybe to protect the oil and prevent it from falling into the hands of ISIS. Well, the president has said, no, that's not why we're there. In his press conference with Erdogan, Turkish President Erdogan had just said, we're there to keep the oil. And that's problematic from a couple of standpoints. One is legal. It's flatly illegal to do that. That's nothing short of piracy. That oil actually belongs to the Syrians and the Syrian government. And two, I think the big thing is that there isn't that much oil in the first place. You're going to have trouble getting it out. And it's really been as a result of coalition bombing has been decimated. So that infrastructure just isn't even there anymore. So it's a rationale that just isn't there with substance. So, I mean, I think until we get a coherent set of objectives that make sense, we're going to be floundering in Syria for some time to come, and I wish I had a better prognosis for that. But that ought to be a concern to anybody, because the American military in particular is doing and acting on our behalf which is why I think it's great that you all are here and are really interested in kind of thinking about these things as well. So thank you very much.
So actually, I was going to focus more on Syria as sort of the genesis of the problems that confront the region emanating from the collapse of the Syrian state in 2011. First of all, I have to say that I did live in Syria for 3 years in the early 1980s. I have great affection for the people in that country, and what they've gone through in the last 8 years is absolutely horrendous. Part of the problem I have in speaking about Syria and from a high altitude perspective is that the language turns it into an object rather than a subject. The uprising in Syria began in March 2011 when some teenagers, actually, in a southern town near the Jordanian border called Deraa, were inspired by brave youth in Tunisia and in Egypt. And these Syrian teenagers, 8 or 10 of them, the accounts differ, just were spraying graffiti with spray paint on the walls in their hometown. The people want the fall of the regime, which had become the slogan of the Arab uprisings in Tunisia and in Egypt. And some of the Syrian government's secret police saw them, arrested them, took them away, and in Syria to be taken away by the security forces, you frequently meant nobody would ever see you again. So there were some protests a couple days later where family members were able to spread word that their children had been arrested. There were protests particularly targeting the governor of the province, who was a relative of President Assad. President Assad up in Damascus sent a delegation down to meet with families to try to find out what would happen. If they could get to the bottom of what happened to these children. As it emerged later, they'd already been tortured. And the government didn't want the families to know that these teenagers had been tortured for spray painting. At the end of 2 weeks, there were protests in Deraa for the government to release these teenagers. A number of people were shot and killed by security forces. And, of course, when the security forces shot and killed some people, this made other residents of the town angry, and they joined protests, and protests grew larger, and then more people were killed. And finally, the government relented and released the teenagers, and, of course, they all bore the marks of very severe torture, which was typical treatment under the Assad regime. And this local spark, in combination with, of course, watching events in Tunisia and Egypt, led to more demonstrations in other parts of Syria. It's important to remember that in these early months of protests in Syria, the protesters were nonviolent, and they were seeking peaceful democratic change. They were seeking an end of corruption, of emergency laws under which security forces could arrest individuals without any explanation and no accountability. So it was a nonviolent protest, and it was the government that deliberately spiked the protests in a violent direction, and it worked. Okay, at first the protesters they organized like little posses to defend them against the security forces, and then as these posses grew larger, the government sent in more heavily armed forces to suppress protests, and eventually the cycle of violence spiraled out of control so that it was impossible to hold nonviolent protests because of the response of the government, and the only way to protest the government was through the barrel of the gun. So now this is telescoping a couple of years' developments, but essentially the government militarized a civilian uprising for reform, and this militarization is what prompted the outbreak of civil war in Syria. And the problem with this, one of the problems with the civil war in Syria, is that it wasn't the government on one side and opposition on the other. The opposition, as Chris observed, was deeply fragmented between liberal forces, between socialists, between different stripes of self-proclaimed religious activists, between atheists. I mean, it was all over the place. And so, as with so much else in Syrian history, there was no consensus on a united front against the government. And it's true, the United States and its allies, I think, could never have found a way to bring these opposition forces together. So in a way, by the summer of 2013, Syria was completely fragmented into zones of conflict under control of different revolutionary forces, some zones of control under the control of the government. The critical moment for the survival of the government, because it was losing control of more and more territory through 2012 and 2013, was intervention by Iran and Hezbollah in southwestern Syria that turned the tide there. Iran saw that it, what it considered to be a valuable strategic asset in the Assad government, was on the verge of collapse. It looked to me and many others at the time that the Assad government was making one mistake after another, which is not surprising because by all indications in the first 10 years of his rule, Bashar al-Assad looked like an idiot. And it was really remarkable to me how the military situation began to turn in the Assad government's favor once the Iranians got involved. And I don't know if anybody knows this, but it looked to me like Iran took over managing the war there, not Assad. He had appointed friends of his to high positions whose only qualification was that they were friends of his. Sound familiar? So I really think the war was managed by the Iranians. That's just speculation on my part. And they were very patient. They were deliberate. They played a waiting game. Of course, the Russians got in. The Kurds in the north broke away rather early in the war. They formed their own autonomous zone, a very odd experiment in a political utopian community inspired by an obscure American political theorist named Gene Sharp, where women had their own councils, their own military forces, probably a higher degree of egalitarian consciousness than you would find anywhere outside Scandinavia. This has all been, of course, compromised, if not wiped out, by the latest turn of events. So the Syrian situation, in short, has gone from dissolution to reconsolidation because of an effective cooperation between the Syrian government, Iran, and Russia. ISIS came into the game rather late, a good 3 years into the war. And the entry of ISIS into this war, of course, engaged American attention and intervention. Whether it was one of the curious things to me about the conversation of late is how it seems as if what Americans used to call the global war on terror, and that was all that was required to wake everybody up, was to say, Islamic terrorists, we have to send troops there, seems to be over. It doesn't seem to faze the public at all that all these talking heads got on TV and said, well, if we pull forces out, the Islamic State can come back and threaten us. Didn't seem to faze many Americans, which could well be a good thing, right? It's not good to be over-afraid. But it does concern me that the decision to withdraw forces in a limited part of Syria could weaken American defenses against a future attack. But the public did not seem terribly concerned about that, and of course they're distracted by other developments. Just a couple of words about Turkey. Turkey, like Syria, is the creation of the 20th century. Turkey created after World War I. Syria created on a map after World War I, but not independent until 1946. Both countries, the people in both countries, have memories of being partitioned and dominated by foreign powers. And it's this historical memory, I believe, that so intensely tilts the playing field against groups like the Kurds, who want some cultural autonomy. The Kurds in Syria did not have cultural autonomy. In 1962, the Syrian government stripped citizenship from about 100,000 Kurds. The descendants now number about 300,000. They're about 10% of the Kurdish population. No citizenship rights. They can't own property. They can't go to university. The government basically is racist against Kurds because they, in the early 1960s, The ideology was Arab nationalism. Syria was an Arab nation. If you're not Arab, well, then you're not Syrian. The same kind of racist ideology is characteristic of the Erdogan policy in Turkey. You do have moderate Kurds. You have a moderate legal Kurdish party. That legal moderate Kurdish party negotiated with the Turkish government in the early 2000s for the simple right to teach their language in school. Erdogan views that as a national security threat, to have newspapers published in the Kurdish. Erdogan thinks that's a terrorist tactic, all right? But he plays on a strain of Turkish nationalism that views any departure from a pure Turkish identity as a threat to the nation, all right? And I don't have to, I think, say too much about how global this sentiment of a narrowing of identity is in the world today. I'm at a loss to explain it, but I know that many Arabs in Syria are glad to see the Kurds get it. Sorry to say that. I've had that sentiment expressed to me by people whom I really like, and I'm sure that Erdogan supporters are glad to see the Kurds get it, because there's a feeling that they're the enemy within, that they're potential traitors. And, okay, yeah, the Syrian Kurds, they do work with outsiders. The Kurds of Turkey, they do work with outsiders because their own governments are quite unfair to them. So my own view is that this is an untenable situation that is being contained by force. I don't know if it will ever be resolved by a redefinition of the nation that allows for pluralism. But short of that, I just see the reformation of power struggles and violence continuing onward.
Thank you so much. Right. I have a couple of questions, actually, for the expert panel members. And starting with you, Larry, you referenced your article, which I've got here, quite a brilliant read. If you haven't read it, I'll strongly encourage you to read it. There's something you said here. You talked about the obviously President Trump pulling out U.S. forces from Syria. Then you also talked about the withholding of military aid to Ukraine. And quite an interesting statement here. These two events, you wrote, taken together, give the perception that the United States is not a very steadfast ally, you said. Can you speak a bit more to that and perhaps establish how both events are somehow correlated?
Sure. I would also say, very near to that in the piece, I also mentioned that it's questionable in my mind whether the United States is still prepared to carry the burdens of being the world's superpower. And I mentioned both President Trump's America First notion, or Make America Great Again, to put it in another phrase, and President Obama's lead from behind. And I cited a question I received at the Royal Jordanian National Defense College after a lecture there, from a student from a country in that region who said, if the United States is not willing to lead, what shall we do? And the answer is, of course, choose someone else to be your big ally, which Russia could be one. Turkey traditionally had a very big role in the region, of course. But notwithstanding Erdogan's neo-Ottomanist sort of desires, it seems to me that the historical memory of Ottoman rule in the Arab world is just as deep-seated as maybe Turkish desires to revive a larger position. As regards the specific point, it seems to me that the the American role in the world is changing, and we don't quite know how to manage that. And in regard to the question of the Ukraine and the that you mentioned, and the question of the Kurdish decision, these are choices we're making, and they're not unreasonable choices, right? I mean, Turkey is a NATO ally. Turkey has a real problem with the Kurds. It's a problem that I think David has identified as part of this global narrowing of identity, which is a really elegant way of putting that, and a sad way, you know. I mean, a globalized world is supposed to be citizens of the world, and increasingly, you know, don't come to my neighborhood unless you speak like me, look like me, cheer for the same team, and all that sort of thing. That seems to be happening in a lot of places. But it's a challenge for the global superpower. After the Cold War ended, we became the global leader, not China, not Russia. And we maintained our high military spending and our global leadership and presence, even though we didn't always lead very effectively. Rwanda, for example, comes to mind. But now there are challengers, and we are not sure, I think, as a country, that we still want to be that global leader. So, I mean, I guess that's what I was trying to get at in that section.
Can I make a comment? I mean, one thing to think about, and you see this a lot in the press, has to do with kind of U.S. credibility, right, being at a weak point. Personally, and folks here I suspect are going to disagree, I actually think that's way overblown, particularly in the limited context of U.S. alliance with the Kurds. The U.S. alliance with the Kurds was always temporary, always had an expiration date, was always focused on the near-term fight against ISIS. Once the ISIS caliphate was taken apart, that shared sense of threat just evaporated. So that alliance was going to go its own way anyway. And if you're, you know, interested in just kind of international relations stuff, I mean, there's a book, I think it was Daryl Preefs did it, on calculating credibility. And, you know, that's not what the U.S. did or didn't do with the Kurds doesn't impact our nuclear deterrent. Right? We've still got a pretty strong nuclear deterrent. It's not going to change Moscow's calculus in terms of an invasion of Europe. So I just think this credibility argument can be overblown.
But aside from the credibility questions, do you think that the West, not just the U.S. in this case, do you think that the West is perhaps in retreat? If you think about the United Kingdom, for example, I mean, it's got its own problems with Brexit, France, it's bogged down with its own issues. Europe is, it's got its own sort of crisis. And the increasing assertiveness of China and Russia, do you think that the West is somehow retreating?
Let me just jump in real quickly, and I'm sure you both want to talk about this too. I mean, I was in the U.K. last year and traveled a good bit from the U.K. Mm-hmm. So I got a chance to see and hear from and solve the Brexit problem every day. Someone wanted me to tell them in the U.K., well, what would you do? Gee, I don't know. You guys have a really sticky problem there. But I got to see that, I've been living abroad and worked abroad in this field for my entire adult life. So it's not like I've never been abroad and seen the United States sort of laughed at and sort of poked at and complained about. But there's always been this sense of the United States is a serious place. And I watched our president's behavior be treated derisively. And I got this day after day after day. And I also was in, one of the places I went was Turkey this summer, where I sat with meetings with all these think tanks and government folks, and government folks masquerading in think tanks, And it was clear that China was coming. There was this real look to the east. Mm. You know, we're the center of the world. That's how Turkey has always seen itself, right? Istanbul is the center of the world. And we've looked to the west for a long time, but now the east is coming. You, professor, I was told, are interested in Syria or Ukraine, but you should be looking at China, because that's where we're looking. Same in the Balkans. So, I mean, I just sense that, or my takeaway from all of these observations, admittedly a lot of anecdotal evidence, right, is that something, I don't disagree fundamentally with Chris's point, but I do think there's this sense the U.S. is not serious anymore or as serious. Yes, we have a very strong nuclear deterrent and a lot of other capability, and that China is rising. And so, I mean, that would be my comment on that. And get out of your way, David and Chris.
Well, you know, as you were speaking about American credibility and perhaps a retreat of the United States in global affairs, I was thinking about, the Fertile Crescent region and Arabia, the zone that I studied the most. And frankly, I don't know if that would be a bad thing. I mean, they're all authoritarian regimes. Most of them have had a lot of support from the United States, economic, military support, diplomatic support. So I don't know that it'd be, a terrible thing for the region, for the U.S. to have diminished standing there. I don't know. It might be better for the United States, too, if it did. It would get perhaps less blame, less animosity. Perhaps, although it's hard to keep, it's hard to find a new enemy. So it's convenient to keep beating up on the old one. But when Obama was president, the Saudis were complaining, and the Gulf Arabs were complaining. The U.S. is abandoning us. So Trump, who considered himself the opposite of Obama, is apparently giving the same impression. The U.S. is pulling back, and maybe that is reflective of sort of a public fatigue, right? The American public might just be fatigued. We've been committed to the globe since 1941, since December 7th, 1941, I guess, right? And, that generation's historical memory is not been kept alive among younger people, and they might just feel like, you know what, I've got the gig economy now, I've got my smartphone. I don't know if people think about Europe, how NATO has kept peace on the European continent now for 70 years, right? When's the last time you had peace in Europe for 75 years? Most of Europe, right, okay. So for 50 years. So when was the last time for 50 years? Was it before, 66 BC, before the Romans conquered it? I mean, Europe's a very belligerent pace. Right? So, but Americans seem to think like they can afford to walk away from NATO. I think they do. I wager that. I think if the president said we're walking away from NATO, his people would say that's fine with us.
Interesting. Now, is there, before I open this up to the audience, is there any sort of silver lining in all of this? What can we take out of this? There's something quite interesting you said, David. You said that when we talk about Syria, we most times objectified. We don't really talk about it as a subject, and I find that quite interesting. Is there a unique opportunity here for the Syrians, for the government of al-Assad, to perhaps create a new constitution, bring the country together, bring the Kurds, bring all aspects of the country together, and so that the people of Syria can probably have a good future for themselves?
I don't think so. Assad is depends on force. He will never agree to a constitution that would diminish any of his power.
There's a lot of blood on the hands there, and it's not clear that the African examples in South Africa, Rwanda, some places where there's been a process that somehow allowed countries to transcend a bloody history, that would work in Syria. And Assad won't give up any of his instruments of power, like David just said. So, and since it's a minority government ruling a majority, that's probably a non-starter.
Mm. But I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Not to be wrong about that.
Well, this is a huge conundrum facing U.S. policy, right? That has to do with kind of reconstruction assistance and kind of gets to point of a potential better future for Syria. I mean, right now, the U.S. government appears hell-bent on not giving any security or reconstruction or economic assistance to Syria as long as Assad remains in power. Mm. Again, I think we all pretty much agree that he's likely to remain in power. For at least the foreseeable future. But there is an opportunity, and this was an opportunity with the Kurds, actually, right, to actually kind of develop those local governance structures, foster those structures so that there would be some kind of basis for self-government in Syria at some future point whenever that transition happens.
Right.
Chris, your article, 10 Hard Realities of America's Next Syria Policy, I found that quite interesting indeed. One of the points you made here, which I found quite interesting, is you said U.S. must re-engage diplomatically with all key players to include Moscow, Iran, Ankara, and Damascus to facilitate needed post-war reconstruction. Do you think the U.S., under the circumstance, has the gravitas for such engagement?
I think we do if we decide we do. But one of the things we have to decide is that we have to admit to the reality, again, Russia is going to play a role in Syria. Iran is going to play a big role in Syria. And so we've got to engage those players. And right now our attitude seems to be, if you're a bad actor, we're not going to engage. That really leaves the Syrians. I mean, the Syrians are the ones who are really suffering the most here, right? And I do think, particularly in terms of policymakers, we often forget that. But, I mean, the humanitarian catastrophe and suffering there is just phenomenal. So, you know, one of the hard things to do might be just to kind of really swallow hard. It's morally repugnant, but let's get some kind of reconstruction assistance into Syria. Do what you can to make sure that Assad doesn't get his hands on it. Work through NGOs if that's possible. That's you know, a tall hill to climb, but something I think at least is worth considering, because I can't see where a failed Syria serves anybody's interest in the near term. So if we're thinking strategically, if we're thinking long term, that may just have to be a shorter term but hard compromise we have to make.
Right. On that note, ladies and gentlemen, I open up the floor for questions, thoughts, and comments from the audience.
Before we begin the question and answer session, we would like to present our panelists with a small gift as a sign of our thanks and appreciation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We will now begin the question and answer session. Since this event is being recorded, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking your question. And as an undergraduate institution, we prioritize student questions. We will now take the first question.
Hi, I'm Sadie. I'm a sophomore. And I have a question for everyone just regarding the displacement camps and the displaced peoples and what policies are being done for that. And how are they contributing to the breeding grounds of insurgency? And if so, why aren't we doing more to, you know, be more actively involved in kind of disseminating them?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't really know how to answer it.
Well, I mean, I think we should be doing more, right? This is an area where I think the U.S. could and should kind of be taking the lead. I mean, but right now we refuse to accept any Syrian refugees into the country. We could at least, it doesn't mean we have to accept 100,000, but we could at least accept, you know, a token number. I don't know what that number is, 10, 20,000. And that would set at least kind of an example for other countries to follow. But we do forget, I mean, the countries in the region are suffering phenomenal economic burdens because of these refugees and displaced people. Right now in Lebanon alone, one out of every five Lebanese is a Syrian. And that's for a country that's going through some pretty tough times. Same thing in Jordan, is host to like 700,000 refugees, a very poor country, really can't afford it. This is one of Erdogan's major points when he was here. We're hosting 3 million Syrian refugees in Europe, and others are not ponying up enough resources. I mean, to me, it makes sense that we ought to be helping those folks, because they're just going to become sources for future kind of disadvantaged, disenfranchised folks who are not happy with life and, you know, subject to recruitment by violent terrorist organizations. So it makes sense we should be doing more, but the reality is we're not.
Erdogan seems to have a plan to send some of the Arab refugees from Syria living in Turkey to go settle in the zone along the Turkish-Syrian border, from which the Turkish armed forces would like to expel Kurds, so have ethnic cleansing and change the ethnic composition of the population along the border. That's not something that these Arab refugees want, by the way. From the few accounts I've read so far, there could be others who look forward to it. Another point to remember is repatriation is something that is terrifying to many Syrian refugees. Remember, they fled not only a war zone, but a regime. And I think that the regime is going to be looking at people who return very suspiciously, right? Did you flee because you were with the rebel forces? How do we know that? They're not very good at keeping records, so they, when they interrogate, they use force, real brutality, to get people to confess to what they think they should confess to. So repatriation, if it happens, is going to be very slow. Yeah.
And I would just add kind of on that last, well, on both comments. I mean, Chris is right, but I think we've only taken 15,000 or 16,000 Syrians since the war began. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he's absolutely right. Why couldn't we take 10,000 or 20,000 or whatever? We're signatory to the UNHCR, so we should be engaged in succoring refugees just like others. But, you know, the narrowing of identity issue, as you put it earlier, maybe is part of the explanation for that. The fear that lingers from the war on terror maybe is part of that. What David just said, sort of the weaponization, this is a region where everything has been, and where in the age of hybrid warfare, everything is weaponizable anyway. Right, I can weaponize my phone and send you social media messages that will manipulate you into doing things, right, if I know the right buttons to push, right? So, which fortunately I can barely use this thing, so you're safe from me. Not so much maybe from the Internet Research Agency, but in any event, refugees have always been a community that you could weaponize. And they're feared in Europe because so many Syrians have already come into Europe, and so many of the governments there have been trying to manage that, even though they're part of the EU or however you want to see the tensions on their policies. And then, as David specifically said about, you know, weaponizing the Syrian refugees in Turkey, this is a real problem. And it was interesting. I went to so many meetings this summer in Turkey where the number kept going up and up. We have 3 million. We have 3.5 million. I think we went to one meeting where they said 5 million. I was looking at my wife up there. The number just kept going up and up. And indeed, Istanbul is awash with Syrian refugees. And so, and in a region where this narrowing of identity, you know, is very important, then that provides a kind of prism through which you see that person or those people. There's no really good solution. This is probably going to get worse because, as was said, you can't go home, because if you're going home, you're going home to the regime that you were fleeing from in the first place. So.
Hi, I'm a senior. I'm an international studies major. I'm Stephanie. And sort of going off of that question, I was wondering, do you think that the international community has a responsibility to protect towards Syria? And do you think anything is likely to happen in terms of the responsibility to protect doctrine?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
Those would be my answers. I don't mean that in a rude way. Mm-hmm. I just mean that we absolutely have a responsibility to protect, or at least the signatories do. And I don't think... I mean, let me be less rude and give that a little more attention. The U.S. government has had Syrian protection activities out of the embassy in Amman, and I think, Scotty, maybe out of the consulate in Istanbul, not out of the embassy in Ankara. But those have either been shut down or have dried up, or the focus, no? Yeah, I was going to go to that, but it... So we're still... Okay. So we're still... Okay. So then I'm going to revise the no. I'll say we're still... Well, at least for the U.S. But I don't think it's we're going to see it... Sure, the countries of first asylum right there, as Chris was saying, in Lebanon and Jordan and so forth. But I thought we were backing away from some of our programming there. Okay.
How much?
The working number is 247.
247.
More question? There's a hand there.
Thanks. Luke Van Antwerp from the Army War College. Quick comment and then a question. Mr. Bolin, you said that we were ill-prepared, or ill-postured to protect the Kurds, and I think technically I agree if ill means not perfectly prepared, but the fact is we had been protecting or at least partnering without Turkey coming in for years. And we were doing it effectively. It was difficult, and their proxies were shooting across the border daily or weekly, and a lot of that had to do with the air cap once that was pulled. But my question for the panel is, at what point do we really, kind of a finer point on the last question, at what point do we have a moral imperative to protect a partner who we had told we were going to be there? I was in a bunch of meetings where Votel and McGurk told these guys we're going to be with you. The partner that spent 11,000 lives versus our six. Yes, an expensive endeavor, but in terms of blood, very cheap on our end. And then I would just highlight one hidden cost, maybe. And on a personal note, we have a small generation of officers and NCOs over there who will never forget this, in my opinion, moral failing. So the question again is, at what point do we have a moral imperative and we depart from the realist perspective of, yep, it's just a policy decision. Thanks.
I'll go first. I know Luke, he's gonna not like this answer, I think. I mean, like I said about Henry Kissinger, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've had the moral imperative all along to stand by our partner, and but that doesn't mean we're going to act morally. And I mean, don't take from that or the fact that I gave the lecture on Kautilya earlier this year that I really believe that we should be amoral like that. I think we should be moral, and we should stand for things. I mean, one of the things that sort of created all of this, you might say, maybe, some people do, is the great speech full of moral values that President Obama gave in Cairo in 2009, in which he told the region that the United States stood for democracy in the region. And then when the Arab Spring happened and we were forced to confront some of our internal moral quandaries and our policy, it was hard for us to chart a new path, or I think it was. Maybe some of the State Department folks here in the audience would say otherwise. So I hear what you're saying, and I agree with it, but I don't think it's going to shape our policy. Normally, therefore, in my experience, when you're going to sell out someone, you do so with as much class and dignity as you can manage, right? And so it's worse when you do it in a sort of, you know, clumsy fashion, maybe. But that's just a Chatham House rule sort of comment, right? Anyway, that's, you know, I'll probably ponder this and seek you out one day at the War College and try to talk to you a bit more about it, because I'll have to think about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a tension between values and interest in foreign policy. Ultimately, interests typically win out. I mean, I think the major lesson to be learned there is, in terms of morals, is you don't make commitments you don't intend to keep. And I don't want to, you know, I'm sure General Votel was speaking, A, from his heart, but B, also from what he had heard from others. But the reality was, President Trump, as a candidate, was talking about ending stupid wars in the Middle East. In March of 2018, he said, "I'm giving you generals 6 months to finish up the ISIS campaign. After that, I'm withdrawing from Syria." In December of 2018, he said it again, "I'm withdrawing from Syria." He was convinced to stay a little bit longer. And then again, just last month, after the phone call with Erdogan, he said, "We're pulling chalk." So, I mean, I think the writing was on the wall, and the moral lesson is, don't make commitments to others that you don't think you can keep.
So, speaking as a gullible American citizen who believes in American values and principles and liberal constitutional democracy promises, I was sickened by the decision. There's that. There's also, it's wonderful fodder for anti-American groups around the world. You can't depend on them, all right? They're feckless. They'll cut and run. And Al-Qaeda is still out there, folks, and they feel like the U.S. doesn't have the stamina. Remember that from a debate? Stamina. The U.S. doesn't have the stamina to stand up to a long-term, really dirty, nasty war. And the Taliban feel the same way. And when they see this behavior in Syria, you think they're going to negotiate with the U.S. and compromise on Afghanistan? They're going to sit back and just say, okay, another president or two, they'll be gone, and we'll come in and pick up the pieces. So, you know, if these parts of the world matter to the U.S., then this matters. If they don't matter, then the U.S. should probably just get out now and abandon the elected government of Afghanistan or the Taliban, and abandon whoever else we said we'd support.
You know, while she's walking around, I just want to make one more comment on this. So I wrote in that piece the other day, maybe you saw it, Luke, I don't know, that in my experience in sort of these planning meetings, and for good reason, of course, we never really discuss what's going to happen when our alliance breaks up. We always plan, okay, Luke and Bill, and, you know, they're going to be with us, but we never really talk about, well, what happens when we're going to change and then we don't need them anymore? because obviously you don't want that to leak out, number one. And number two, we don't think that way going in. We think these are great fighters, Bill and Luke, by golly, we're going to win this thing. And we don't think that we're going to get there. Now, once you've been around the block a few times, you sort of know. I can remember back in the 80s with the Afghan Mujahideen in Pakistan, and they kept saying, Larry, you're going to abandon us. And I said, no, the U.S. will abandon you, but I will never abandon you. But, you know, of course, we all knew that when we were done trying to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, we were going to abandon the Afghans, which, of course, we did. And so did the Soviets in the end. So, but, yeah, sickening is another word for it.
Hi, I'm Jake. I'm a sophomore. Professor Bolin, when you were responding to that last question, you were saying that more or less the writing had been on the wall for almost a year by the time we withdrew from Syria. So I was wondering what we did or could have done to better prepare the Kurds for that eventuality in that time that we assumed we were going to be, or if we just sat complacent and assumed that we could continue to convince the president to stay.
No, I mean, you know, one, I'm not part of the internal deliberations, so I can't tell you for sure. But I do know just from reading what you're reading, I mean, Brett McGurk was the presidential envoy heading up the anti-ISIS campaign. And he actually was working with the Kurds when we had a strong military presence about 2000 with them. And he was actually encouraging the Kurds to actually reach some kind of accommodation with Damascus. In other words, using what leverage they had with the U.S. presence there before it was really put into doubt to their mass advantage, so they could achieve whatever deal, the most autonomy they could possibly achieve. But my understanding is when a new crew came in, particularly Ambassador Jeffries came in, because of the anti-Iran focus, they said, no, don't engage with Damascus at all. We're going to be here with you. And so the Kurds kind of backed off that, although they've always had a running, ongoing dialogue with Damascus. So that wasn't new. But I think that was the opportunity, and that was the right approach, actually, was, look, we're not going to be here forever with you, particularly once ISIS is effectively defeated. So you need to start thinking about how you're going to be dealing with those kind of trade-offs now, while we're still here. And again, I think we didn't take advantage of it. The Kurds didn't take sufficient advantage of it.
My understanding, Chris and Larry, my recollection of this is a little shaky, but in the early stages of the Syrian uprising, the Syrian government pulled its officials and troops from the Kurdish zone, mm-hmm. because their conversations with Kurdish political activists were that the Kurdish cause was separate from the Syrian uprising cause because of the Islamist elements in the Syrian uprising cause. So that the Syrian government kind of subcontracted the border zone to the Kurdish parties to keep the Arab Islamist fighters out of there. Right. So there's not the same degree of opposition between the YPG and the Syrian government as there is between the Syrian government and the other elements of the uprising. Is that
accurate? Okay. I think that's right.
So they would much prefer the Syrian government to the Turks.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so they've made that deal with the devil.
Without a one?
Well.
You're dabbling in their devil.
We have time for two more questions.
Colonel Jamal from UAE Army. I am an international student at Army War College. First, thank you for the panelist and the such great information provided for us today. Great insight. My question regarding the whole Middle East and the interest of the United States in the Middle East. As a big picture, we just will zoom out from Syria and we'll see from... Also, you include Libya, Sudan, and Israel, Turkey, rule of Saudi Arabia, and how the sanction in Iran right now, and what's happening in Iraq, in Lebanon. Do you think the interest of the United States will be still as it is, or it will be changed with the same values? And thank you very much.
Well, that's a big question.
Well, they're all great questions.
Yeah, yeah.
I do think U.S. interests in the Middle East are changing, at least the perception of them is. I mean, you had President Obama did an interview with Jeffrey Goldberg with The Atlantic when he was kind of on the way out. And he asserted very forcefully that, look, U.S. interests in the Middle East are simply less engaged now than they have been in the past. And I think it's useful to remember, and that's a two-way street. And we're not the only ones conducting a global pivot to Asia, right? Actors in the region are conducting their own pivot to Asia. The energy resources are flowing eastward toward Asia much more so than they're flowing westward toward Europe and the United States. So that was kind of the foundation, I think, ultimately, of U.S. interests in the region was kind of, we'll protect the oil and energy reserves, provide you that security guarantee, and that's just kind of that is weakening with these tectonic plates moving increasingly toward Asia. So I think the reality is we have less interest. That doesn't mean we don't have any interest. So I think you will see, you know, a relative disengagement from the region.
I guess I would add to that as I said before, there's long been this, in my mind, tension in U.S. policy toward the Middle East, that we've wanted divergent interests, and we've classified them for many years as vital interests, right, or at least as very significant interests. And the most obvious divergence has been between supporting the governments that have oil, that like yours, that may or may not have a real democratic system, or maybe only a somewhat democratic system. We've also supported Israel, that has a democratic system, but doesn't get along very well historically with most of its neighbors, and has no oil, and so we've had these tensions, and we've always tried to maintain it through, you know, bilateral relationships with these particular countries. I think as we go forward, in light of the trends that Chris is talking about, it's likely that we will continue to sort of say we stand for democracy, but since that puts a real problem in the region because people want democracy, or at least, you know, more money, and that runs them sometimes against their government, puts them against their governments, I think we're likely to support particular countries in the region, like yours, like Israel, countries that are friends, countries that have something that we want, whether it is a good standard of living, a good military, previously good allied relationship, which would apply in both UAE and Israel's case and other countries' cases. And then I think we'll probably be less forward-focused on some of the other countries and issues in the region as we shift our focus more towards Asia or to whatever's going to happen in Europe. I heard from David we're getting out of NATO, so, you know.
So, you know, a couple of things. First of all, I wonder how officials in the UAE and the other GCC governments feel about the president's change of policy in northern Syria, right? Of course, different interests, you might say, in the United States, but just the rapidity and suddenness of it might have been a little alarming. The other thing is somehow that Iran has fallen off the front pages, even though Iran is inching one by one towards violating one aspect or another of the JCPOA 2015. And I remember not too long ago, Israel was planning an attack, the U.S. was planning an attack, different people in the Gulf were reportedly egging the United States and Israel to attack Iran. Certain elements in Iran probably would not feel too bad if they were attacked by Western powers, because it would show that the political alignment in their country that is open to the West is wrong. I think this is still a really huge danger, and I think that could bring the Middle East back front and center very fast. So I'm just kind of wondering if there are contacts, behind-the-scenes contacts, maybe Rudy Giuliani's in charge, between GCC leaders and the Iranians. I mean, that's a mission he could actually, carry out that would be constructive. But, I wonder about that. That to me, the most constructive development that can come out of the Middle East anytime soon would be a rapprochement between the GCC and Iran. I don't know if that's in the cards or not, but that would be fantastic because it would have stabilizing effects in Iran, Syria, and Lebanon.
Yeah. I would be shocked to see that under this administration.
You don't think Giuliani?
No, well, okay. Maybe.
Pretty active.
I mean, he's pretty agile, yeah. But... I a lot of the senior officials in State Department and, mm-hmm. and National Security Council and DOD have been loyally anti-Iran. And anything could happen. And I agree, this is a critical, mm-hmm. this is the big issue in the Middle East, mm-hmm. right? But I just don't see it.
Could pull an Oslo. They did that behind U.S. back.
Okay.
Never know.
Well, there are signs that there are back-channel contacts between Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Iran, right? And the UAE actually, had an agreement to work some kind of maritime cooperation in the Strait of Hormuz, too. So, there are some telltale indications of at least an easing of tensions right now, which I agree would be a welcome development. Mm-hmm. Another conundrum for U.S. policy, though, is the Arab uprisings. Because for the last several decades, we've been working with authoritarian governments in the region for good reason, right? There are a lot of good reasons for doing that. The Arab uprisings, I think, at least provide an opportunity for the U.S. to rethink that, maybe expand our contacts much more broadly to key civil sector mm-hmm. players to the extent we can. So there may be a silver lining there.
Mm-hmm. Any other question?
No more. We're done.
All right.
All right. Are there any more questions? We have time for one more. Okay.
Oops. Oh, one more.
If we look at our... and we've talked about this, our engagement in the Middle East. The real engagement began when the first military on the ground, other than the leftovers at the end of the Second World War in Iran, was in 1958 in Lebanon. And that was due to the Cold War at its height, a concern that that government might fall to communists. And for the next 40 years, our presence, I think, was built around our contest with the Soviets but when the wall came down, when the Soviet Union dissolved, the need to be there seemed less. That we had won the Cold War, people wanted to come home, but somehow we were engaged and continued to be engaged in the wars there, the two Gulf Wars, and the fight against terrorism. I think that, and we were talking earlier about getting the American public to be engaged here, I think they are tired of 25 years of war. We have been engaged in the Middle East, and not only in the Middle East, but around the world. We have forces in dozens and dozens of countries around the world. And the question will be, and I'm not sure if we've seen this in the debate among the Democratic candidates, but for this election next year, the question will be for the American people, what do we as Americans want role, what role do we want to play in the world? Is there an existential threat which we faced against the Soviets for that period of the Cold War? Why should we be engaged now in the Middle East? We are exporting, we're the number one exporter of hydrocarbon fuels. And that is a debate. I think we have talked about our values and freedom and democracy, the Western liberal system, and it's going to be a difficult question that the American people are going to have to ask, and what the candidates, how they'll answer those questions. And it does come back to a question of what are our interests now in the Middle East? Why should we be engaged? Why should we support the Kurds or not support the Kurds? And I don't know, from the panel, if that you feel that there is a specific interest for our engagement there. And I'll just throw that out as it's probably one we have to think about for a while, go to sleep, and maybe dream a little bit.
Well, last time I heard, ISIS is still active. And last I heard, terrorism is a concern of the American government and American citizens. So there's one reason.
Yeah, Sherwood, there were six big interests that we traditionally articulate. But I agree with your some of which are still relevant, as David just said. But rather than get through all of that at the end of the evening, I'll just say that I agree with your opening point, right, about I wrote this once in an article, that we used to be, our presence in the Middle East used to be as diplomats, oil engineers, and educators, and, some missionaries. I mean, there was no military presence, and if the military went in, they went in and they came out again. And then Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and other things sort of changed that. And now we seem to have a permanent presence there, as well as sort of everywhere else in the world that's of any consequence to us, right? And that is potentially problematic because the military has the most expensive tool in the toolkit, and the one that can get people killed, is the one that you should be careful about sending somewhere, or at least that's been how we see that. What I have always told, and there are several of my students I see here tonight from this year's class, as well as Luke up there and some others, I've always told them when we're studying Thucydides, fear, honor, and interest, right? I always say, I'm looking at Craig now, I always say, look, you go to war for fear, but you can't fight a protracted war with fear as the motivation because people can't be fearful forever. Sooner or later, they've got to move on with their lives. And so, yeah, we've got this long presence in the region that I don't think quite matches our interest, as Chris was saying earlier. But we still have interest there. And we have sort of structural commitments now in places like UAE and elsewhere that are going to be hard to disentangle ourselves from. So, I think I'll sleep on this one.
Yeah, the big problem, this just builds on Larry's point, is, the U.S. public and maybe even the foreign policy establishment has kind of conflated U.S. engagement with U.S. military engagement. We don't think we're engaged seriously unless we've got a substantive military presence. But if you want to make that shift, which I think is well overdue, that will require an investment in our diplomatic instruments, a willingness to invest in economic instruments, not only the negative instruments of sanctions and punishment, but also positive developmental assistance. And, you know, it's a lot easier to drum up support financially in Congress for the military. It's a lot tougher case to make for building up the State Department or U.S. AID or other instruments, non-military instruments of power. So I think that's it's a fundamental challenge. And it's definitely worth, you know, discussion, debate.
That it's not just us. And that's where we need NATO. And that's where we need our allies in East Asia. If we don't work with them and treat them as equals, to the point, because a lot of the resources need to come from others. It's not just the United States. But I agree with you that it's the other elements. It's the diplomacy and the information and the economics that help us be where we are. And being able to make a contribution to peace and stability.
And when you don't have the resources, you got to be smarter. That's me.
This concludes tonight's program. Please join me in thanking our panelists.